Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, it is Thursday. It is Toy Department time. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. We have some tech issues happening today. So I apologize if you can't fully hear me. I'm talking out of a professional mic on a professional broadcast board. Kolsky's doing a home computer setup. He has determined that this is somehow my fault.
I didn't say it was your fault.
But and not the fault of his home computer at Skype. But here we are. We're going to talk.
It's a very you've presented our situation
accurately.
Through a very specific lens, is what I would say.
Specific. If by specific you mean correct, I agree with you.
That is not what I mean. But your volume is going to be fine for the listeners. It's just that there are probably going to be times where I talk right over you because I can't hear you.
Okay.
And you may sound a little tinny because you have jacked the volume up so loud on your end.
All right. Should we talk about stuff?
Yeah, we should. But just for the record, it's clearly your fault. I think we should start with challenge.
All right, let's start with the challenge. You know, I was excited about the experience of watching, these kind of commercial-free episodes. And I still am. Like, it's still pleasant in terms of watching. But it is a little less show, for sure. You know, like, you get through these things in 45 minutes.
Yeah, it's not really less show, but it feels a little less. I mean, I'm skipping commercials anyway, so it's not, like, a huge difference. But there is something to what you're saying. I will say this, too. I was very excited, and still am, to be watching adults who know how to play the game play the game. But the lack of, with the notable exception of Ayana, insane messiness does, like, slow down the pace of the show a bit.
Yeah, I also think now, because you're dealing with adults who have real life problems,
right, less drama.
Yeah, but also, like, they have real, like, actual problems, and, you know, the show is essentially, like, filmed over, like, 2 weeks, right?
Right.
I think that seems like it makes it more likely that people just quit, which is that, and the fact that there are alternates at the ready, I guess.
Yeah. You know what
I mean? Seems like people are just not afraid to quit, and I'm not, that is not shade at Tony at all, because it sounds like whatever was happening with him, it was very little debate about whether he was going to quit. He just needed to leave. You know what I mean?
Right. That could happen to anyone. Obviously, we don't know what's going on in his life, but, you know, hopefully everything's okay. It certainly seemed like an emergency situation, and no one's going to begrudge him that. Janelle, you know, we talked about it. Like, just if that's your attitude, don't come. It's fine. Nobody will miss you. So that, you know, didn't Janelle quit before? Like, I feel like it's a Janelle problem and a coincidence more than a reflection of the show. Because I think in reality, like,
I don't think she quit before. Am I wrong about that?
I can't remember. But to me, that was just, like, one person making a specific choice. My instinct is the short time period makes them maybe more likely to stay in some cases.
You would think. But I feel like we have a fair number of people that quit this show over the course.
Yeah, but I think that has more to do with people not being in shape or not being mentally prepared for what they're getting into.
That could be true.
Which, again, you understand after being away from the game for a lot of these people for a long time. It's obviously a very unique situation to put yourself in, and it takes a toll on everybody, young and old. So,
like some folks here, right, who like had never been in an elimination because when they were on the show, they weren't doing eliminations.
Right. And maybe that's the first thing we should talk about is the elimination here, which was really pretty good, and if not super competitive. And I thought both of the winners like put themselves squarely in the threat group, right? I mean, like, Ayana is bigger than Rachel, but Rachel showed that obviously she's strong. She won on her endurance, right? Which is huge for.
I mean, put them in the threat group implies that they weren't there before.
Sure,
but, you know, with Rachel, it was someone I immediately identified as a top threat. You know what I mean?
I agree with you from an analysis standpoint, but there is something to not playing for 15 years or whatever it's been, and just having an opportunity to show that you're still, you know, that motherfucker. Use TJ's parlance.
Spent those 15 years pretty much working out nonstop. So.
Of course. I don't think anybody doubted Rachel. I'm just saying she put it on wax, right? Like, it's still a meaningful moment. And for Kefla, I still am afraid I'm going to mess up his name. That was impressive. Yes, Cyrus is old, but, like, he showed strength, and then he twerked.
I agree.
That it was an impressive performance. Yeah, that's weird. That is weird, right?
You're back.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there.
Wait, so you could tell?
Yeah.
All right, well, I think you can turn your mic down.
Okay, great.
Well, I'm glad we addressed this in the beginning now.
Look at that. Magically fixed.
Yeah, yeah.
So clearly,
I think problem. You can... sure.
All right, let's get back to... I want to just get back to the point I was making, which is that I think it was an impressive performance.
Yes.
For sure. But I also think it was a specific performance. Like, he's a big, strong dude, and that was an elimination that very specifically relied on that skill. And as we know, you know, maybe you get one or two of those in a season. So I don't know that I would say that makes him a huge threat through the whole game, although I think other players may, I don't know, it seemed like everybody was pretty impressed.
I mean, that's what I'm speaking to, really, right? I'm not going to now, I don't know, have we talked about who the favorite would be?
Well, yeah, we did a little bit. So who is your favorite on the men's side?
Now I'm trying to think about it. I'm not sure I really sussed out an order. I guess... If I had to pick going in to the competition, I might have gone with Leroy or... Yeah, I probably would have gone Leroy, I guess. Having watched, I might add Adam up at the top. He has been... frankly awesome. He's been the best.
Yeah, I'm with you on Adam. He was also, it's like he hasn't been on the show in a long time, but I think he was pretty good when he was on the show too.
Well, right, and that's the thing with Kefla that I will say is, although he only showed off a specific skill, it's a base athletic skill, and I think there's something too for these over 45s just being like, yeah, I'm still in shape. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, Adam and Kefla have both, they both got to be pushing 50. I mean, I think Kefla's 49, he said.
Adam is 45.
Okay. All right. But still, like, it's been a long time since he's been here. And like winning a couple early challenges definitely changed my view of him as a competitor.
He is a one-time winner, Adam, sorry, for the Gauntlet, which I think was a team challenge, was it not?
I believe so.
No.
No. I don't know. He won the Gauntlet. He has 11 daily wins in his three seasons. 12 if you count All-Stars.
Four.
Or is it
13 now? Because didn't he win two? Didn't he win the first one and then this one? Whatever. They may not have updated this week. Anyway, the point is, I think that would be my top two right now would be Leroy and Adam. And Leroy at this point, like, I know what he's capable of physically, but it's as much his social game and where he stands socially as anything.
Yeah. You know, I would throw Brad in there. I don't think
tough.
He's done great so far, but he's a past winner. He's strong as hell. He's slightly crazy.
The Rachel Brad pairing was definitely all brawn, no brains. They really struggled to line up some dominoes.
Is she described it?
What did she say?
Muscles on muscles, I believe.
Muscles on muscles, yes. They had that. They had that going for them. They did not have any brain power for that pairing. I thought in general, like, everything has been good. Nothing has been particularly spectacular or noteworthy or you know, all I've really wrote down, I've said everything that was in my notes already, basically. You know, it was Adams impressed me, it was Rachel and Brad as a team being stupid, it was Kefla, like, you know, like I said in my notes, and I'm changing my pronunciation every time, I'm so self-conscious about this, he was just way too strong for Cyrus, right? It's not that he's, oh, damn, watch out, he's the favorite now. But, like, he showed a level of physical competency that I think puts him towards the top. And then Rachel's, you know, that's the trainer endurance. Like, that workout your trainer has you doing, they're doing it, like, six times a day.
She's doing it, you know, like, I mean, we've talked about doing her workouts.
Talked about doing her workouts.
And, like, she's doing the workout while you're doing the workout, but she's also, like, talking through it, which I could not do.
No.
Right now.
No, I'm trying not to throw up when I do those.
Yeah, she's a badass. That much I am certain of. I did have a few more things. I mean, I feel like we need to talk about the whole Ayana thing, right? At least a little bit.
Well, I mean, like we talked about her last week, and she didn't necessarily do well. Okay. Last week, with Ayana, it seems like, and she's not the only person in the history of the challenge that I would say this about, but it seems like she is just going to be crazy. And there are times where that crazy will serve her well because she's not an idiot. And so sometimes her willingness to be crazy can be an effective strategy, as it was last week. But ultimately, she's going to be crazy in a damaging way. And the way she was crazy this week was when Cam came to her with something other people were saying about her, and they definitely were. She turned it into a Cam is attacking me, Cam is coming after me, and all of a sudden the whole house was like, okay, you're out of here.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because you're right. Like, she's not dumb. She's not insensitive. She's not, like, she seems like a pretty smart person and generally, I think, a decent person trying to put her life together. But, like, there's just a total lack of self-awareness, I feel like, with her that is just really weird. Like, at one point, she's like, some people in the house are very loud and intimidating.
Yeah, I know. I know.
I'm like, yeah, you. Yep.
So that running person. Around screaming.
So I don't, you know, it's just weird for her, like, not to understand that, like, you flat out lied on someone.
Yep.
Like, on purpose.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, with the house, like, for you to not think, like, there might be some blowback coming for that. You know what I mean? And then, like, you took a normal situation with a really popular person in the house and, like, blew it up. You know what I mean? The whole house at 3 o'clock in the morning. Like, I don't, what do you think?
The lady who is waking up to pump milk for her baby. That's who you decided to pick a fight with.
Yeah. You know,
that's smart.
You might get defensive in that moment, but you took the nuclear option.
Right.
Immediately. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And then you stood too close to your own bomb. I mean, it's just, and again, this is an extreme version because she is an extreme personality, but this is not new territory. Somebody does this most seasons.
I agree, but it's like, it just frustrates me because if it's like, if you're really there and playing for your kids and you want to get them a future, then you
I will say that
seem like that. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I would say it in reverse, right?
You got something to protect. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. I would say it in reverse. Like, you cannot play that way and then play the, I'm just trying to provide for my poor kids card. Right? Like, everyone there has problems. Like we said earlier, these are grown adults with some of them with families, some of them with not, but I guarantee all of them have problems and they're real. You know what I'm saying? None of these people are like, if they were superstars living on Easy Street, they wouldn't be here. So I'm not super comfortable with being asked to have sympathy after the shenanigans.
Yeah. And there definitely were some shenanigans.
There were shenanigans. Shenanigans were had.
So, do you think it will be less fun with her no longer in the house?
I mean, to a degree, right? But something usually pops up, and there's still plenty of personality here. Like, we've barely gotten Ryan. And there's no way Ryan's not still awesome. We've barely gotten the Nicole and Laurel drama that we know is coming. And it looked like somebody had hurt feelings in the previews from next week. So again, she is a source of excitement that is departing. But I also feel like a source of excitement that maybe has run its course anyway.
Yeah, fair enough. Ryan got off my burn of the week this week, by the way.
Did he?
Yeah. It's Cyrus has clearly been hitting the gym in his time off in the old age home.
I mean, dude, 51.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody's Mark Long, for God's sakes. Like, he's a normal human. It's funny because a lot of these people, they'll be like, oh, he's 47. Wow, he looks great. And Cyrus is like, he's 51. And it's like, yeah, okay. Yeah,
I can see it. He did lose a ton of weight, though, clearly.
He looks great.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that he doesn't look good. It's that he does look 51. You know, like, it's a believable age for him. And that is an achievement just to get in there. I know he's there for 5 minutes, but to get in there and just, like, get your ass kicked on TV, shout out to him.
There were some other, I thought, really great quotes in the show that were not necessarily burns.
Yeah, that's true. I did not clock the Ryan burn, although now that you say it, I remember it. So I didn't have a burn, but there were a lot of good lines.
Kiefla talking about three brothers in the bottom for Domino's in Africa. Jasmine going, now you're going to see the Bride of Chucky.
Yeah, but Jasmine in general, I have to say, that actually is an observation that I wanted to make, is she obviously still has a crazy streak, right? And we love her for it. But her, like, level of interview game has gone up.
Yep.
She is my favorite ITM on the show right now. Like, she is having fun. She's clever. She's great.
Yeah, in a pretty deep group, I would say, of ITMs.
Yes, agreed. There's a lot of people with appeal for different reasons too. It's a great sort of, like, diverse bunch of characters. But she is my favorite for sure.
And then I got one more, which was Lee trying to break down the can I be a peacemaker in this Ayanna thing. Yeah. It's just, I'm not fucking Dr. Phil.
Also, just the can I just say the joy with which TJ said the words domino motherfucker.
Yeah.
You were talking about the lack of commercials, which is nice, but that so far has been by far the best part of this being on Paramount Plus and not on another actual TV.
Yeah, I really wish they'd let him curse all the time.
Oh my God, he was so happy. Domino motherfucker. It was great. And shout out to them for naming a game that.
Agreed. And another shout out, I would say, for the producers, I thought the letting Tina narrate the previously on at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
It's a nice little wrinkle.
Well, you know what? That's old school. They used to do that back in the day. And they used to do weird stuff like jump in the pool and be like, last time on the challenge. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. I guess they were doing that for a minute. I'd forgotten about those.
Yeah. So I also enjoyed that. It was somebody else last week, but it was also a challenger. I forget who.
Yeah, maybe just Tina. Just
Tina's jumped. A delight.
She's such good TV. All
I love
the time.
Tina. this is a Tina plus zone on the toy department.
She's like, I work so hard for it.
She's like from spilling her drink right after arriving, straight through losing her star. Just a class A performance on all fronts. 100%.
While we're here, what did you think of the Rachel move to just transfer stars among her friends rather than take one either from Steve or Carl Maria?
Well, I mean, to hear her tell it, Steve is her friend. And it's worth
her friends.
Yeah, you know. But not Kara. It's worth noting that Kara did just kind of step away from her generation a bit to defend Rachel, even though it didn't amount to anything. So I get it. And I also think it's natural, but I think we're all fretting too much about stars.
Agreed.
If it's a six-person final, it's not like they're going to be like, all right, time for the final when there's 10 people left and the four who don't have stars are just like, well, shit. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to have to go get them.
Kara especially.
Right. You're going to have to go get them. And avoiding making an auxiliary enemy is probably the right way to go. Yeah. Now, I understand why Cam would say she should have taken Kara's star, but I do think Cam is over-planning star acquisition right now.
Yeah, but I also think Kara might have been making an enemy in Cam in the service of protecting her star. And I think Brad kind of had it right in that, like, you know, you're going to have to protect that star for a long time. And maybe you didn't think about that. I think all of them should be thinking about that of like, there's plenty of time to give your star back and just go get it again. You know, right. Like, so,
I agree. That's how I would have approached it. And so I don't know that Kara needed to do what she did. I think Rachel may have just transferred stars between her friends anyway, knowing that someone's going to have to go get one down the road.
Yeah, I think I would have gone with Steve and just been like, hey, man, I'm sorry. I didn't have a lot of other choices. And, you know,
right.
I'll do what I can to help you get it back. And, you know, it's probably what I would have done.
Yeah, that would have been a tough break for Steve, though, because he did actually have to do an elimination.
Yeah. Shout out to Steve for rocking the CPAP in the background of
Steve. That's representation right
that's
there.
That's you're gonna see that on All Stars and maybe not on the regular show a whole lot kind of situation.
I guess but you know, people on the regular show should take care of their health as well.
They should. They definitely should. Just
it's not so hot, I guess. It's less hot.
Yeah, 100%.
Speaking of hot, should we talk about Top Chef?
Yeah, let's talk about it. Let's slide to Top Chef.
Okay. I have more notes about this.
Okay, good. What did you think of the Wisconsin Supper Club? I guess you're a Midwesterner, you know, by birth, so you probably have some
familiarity. I'm a Midwesterner by youth.
I didn't know you weren't born in Chicago.
Brookline, Massachusetts. Only lived there till I was 4 and a half. So
gotcha.
But
you were raised in Chicago.
I was raised in Chicago. Supper clubs are not super a thing in Chicago. I certainly am not in the supper club class.
I still haven't been to one, even though I definitely live in supper club country.
They are a thing. Yeah, it's more of a. It's a, you know, Chicago is only really the Midwest by location and, you know, a portion of the population. It's not, it doesn't have the, it's too big a city to be the real Midwest, unlike Milwaukee, which is like probably, you know, Milwaukee and Minneapolis.
Size city to be the real Midwest.
Yeah, Milwaukee and Minneapolis are both, you know, real cities, but definitely Midwest.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's... Not to get too far into Midwestern stuff.
Minnesota brings a different northern angle to it. Don't get me wrong. It's not Wisconsin.
Minnesota's upper Midwest. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, say, there's definitely different flavors of Midwest. And I feel like Minnesota's like pretty different from Illinois. Like, not, you know, I'm not even talking about Chicago. Just
Southern Illinois, Indiana, Ohio. That's one brand. Then there's like the Michigan, Wisconsin, Lake brand of Midwest, and then there's Minnesota's kind of its own thing. But anyway, in terms of those types of traditions, Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin are probably the spots for supper clubs, I feel like. But again, I'm not an expert. I will say, like, it is capturing an essence, right? That style of meal is capturing an essence of what might be called Midwest finery, or, you know, from another perspective, might not be called finery at all. But it's a thing.
Yeah. Also, things they might serve at Culver's.
Right. Right. None of it is. But in a way, I think that makes it kind of a cooler challenge, because they have to make it something you would never serve at Culver's, right? Like, the real supper club is serving the so-called classics.
I mean, I don't know what they never really say the opposite of elevate, but Culver's is just taking the supper club and de-elevating
That's
it.
Right. You know,
whereas this is taking the supper club and elevating it.
Right. Right. And I actually think, although a supper club doesn't necessarily excite me in isolation, I did find this to be a fascinating challenge, and it did give like a diversity of dishes and a bunch of different approaches, and I thought that was cool. Can we talk about the sauce guy first, though?
Yeah, sure. Those are some weird ass sauces,
right? Shout out Chef Carson Gully with the weirdest collection of crazy sauces I've ever heard of. Raisin sauce with like ham
and fat and like Just pick the weirdest ones out of the bunch.
I don't know, because there was a Creole sauce and a tartar sauce, right? So like, it was a mix. But Figaro sauce, like, there was, you know, it did sound like half of them were made up for like a wait, don't tell me game of like, is this a sauce or? You know,
would you make it up?
Prison.
No, that was quite interesting, and I would say that's a guy I didn't know about, and I think that it's cool of them to highlight him for sure.
And Kamau Bell, always fun to see Kamau Bell.
Yes, but I don't know, man. Some of those did not sound good. They did not sound good.
No, man, I did not want raisin sauce at all, and when Michelle was in the bottom, I was like, yeah, man, look what you made her do. You know, like, come on, raisins and ham fat, what are we doing here? Like, that your raisin and ham fat sauce was not our favorite dish. It's like, fuck you. Especially when, you know, Amanda is down there because her sauce was basically gelatin, and Kevin tried to make schnitzel out of a roasted pepper, which was one of the most confusing things I've ever seen. Like, I don't understand. Can I just say, pretty weird they brought a French chef who's no good on this show. Like, I mean, is this just a fuck you to France? The guy makes a significant error in every challenge.
Well, all right, I will say he is a French pastry chef.
Oh, is he?
So, yeah, right. I mean, like, well, his restaurant is. Yeah, I mean, it's. I don't think it's a restaurant. I think it's a more like a bakery almost. But he's. He's making pastries in Austin.
Well, that makes sense because he's like, I'm so excited to cook a Jew, and they're like, bro, your steak is raw. Like, he just got lucky he was on the winning team. I think he might have got sent home.
Was he on the winning team? I thought he was up. I thought they just decided that the overcooked fish was worse than the raw steak.
No, Rossica and Kevin, both of whom had bad weeks, were on the winning team. The losing team was Charlie, Amanda, who made the only good thing, Manny, who also didn't cook his beef right, and then that weird dessert with the...
Oh, I'm confusing Manny's and... that's what it is.
Yeah. And then it was Danny who they screwed over and gave like $70 out of the $1,000. That was unbelievable. I couldn't believe she got away. Okay, we got to talk about that actually. Before we get into the actual Supper Club challenge, they went shopping with $1,000 for five people. Three people put their groceries on. It was $600. Perfect. Yeah. One more person puts their groceries on. It was $938.
Yeah.
She spent $338.
Dessert, I might add.
On a dessert that was unnecessarily complicated. Yeah. How did they not stop her then? Okay, if she spent $250, $270, all right. But to leave Danny with literally $60... to make something that was supposed to have multiple parts.
Making a raw appetizer course, though, like you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
But it was supposed to have multiple parts.
Full 200. You know what I'm saying?
I understand, right? And that's why I'm saying if they left him with even $100, but $60, and his thing, they literally were like, why wasn't there more?
Yeah, I know.
And by the way. One of the best things, one of the things that recommended the winning team as the winning team was a fancy-ass mousse that was made for the relish tray. So, yeah. Like, suggesting that because it was raw, it didn't need as much money. I mean, maybe to an extent, but, like, shorting it the way they did definitely screwed over their team.
Yeah, a little bit. Oh, for sure. And I do think it seemed like they took that into account.
They took it into account with regards to not eliminating Danny, but they did not. They can't take it into account.
Asking about it, you know what I mean?
Well, no, I know. I mean, I think they wanted to understand it.
Yeah.
And I think when they realized that, they had the same reaction I did, which is like, how the hell did you let her get away with this? And like, how did she think it was okay?
Yeah.
Because again, because
there was a whole argument with Michelle and Tom that they sort of really seemed to edit out.
Yeah.
Where I think Tom at the end was like, yeah, I understand. Like, you didn't have enough pineapple and you did the most with the pineapple you could. Right. And that's why it was enough pineapple in the dish. But I think that's where they got to. It was a little hard to tell.
Yeah. But that to me was a conversation of like, yeah, it's hard. The Laura spending $338 is a conversation of like, that's unacceptable. And you should not have let her do that. How often on Top Chef have we seen them be like, okay, well, then don't get this, don't get that, don't get this. Like, it is your responsibility as a team, the other four people, really the other three, because obviously Danny is saying, I need more money, to be no, you have to give back.
Like, cutting her out of that cocktail. Like, yes. She was by the we're gonna have a dessert and a cocktail thing, right?
But it's their responsibility as a team to be like, no, we're not sorry, look, there's just not enough money to have the cocktail, make the dessert.
I guess that ultimately that's true, but I just don't think that, especially in that moment when you're like, you're eating the checkout. You have to leave the store. You know what I mean?
But that's like, what I'm saying. We've seen that. We've seen so many chefs over the years be like, okay, then actually don't get that cheese. Don't get that booze. We'll pivot. And I think,
clearly like, one of the killers there. So.
Yeah, they just dumped it on Danny, though, is my point, instead of trying to shoulder it as a team and rein in the ladies spending, like, you're supposed to spend 20% of the budget, and she spent almost 35%.
Yeah, pretty wild.
It's pretty so crazy.
On dessert
that didn't turn out well. And the most insane irony is that the thing everybody said was like, you did too much, which they could have solved just by trying to be reasonable with the budget in the first place.
Yeah.
Anyway, the best things this week generally seem to be like chicken with katsu, like katsu chicken, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody liked the katsu chickens.
It really went well. Otherwise, like, you know, and Dan's relish tray, right? Otherwise, nothing was super great. So although I was intrigued by this challenge, it did not seem to turn out a lot of excellent food. And I think it is...
I knew this is the week after the chefs got a dressing down about, hey, step it up. You know,
yeah, it's a bummer. It's a bummer. They didn't step it up, and that was in my notes. Like, you had to get a pep talk last time. You got to do better than this. This is not up to snuff. The amount of, like, meat that has been poorly cooked so far is kind of shocking.
Yeah.
Protein, I guess I should say. The amount of protein, because some of it's been fish. But like Rosica, even, who had been so good up to this point, just in terms of like her floor seemed very high, oversalted the hell out of a fish and then had like a shitty attitude about it.
Yeah. I gotta say, I think Michelle is my number one contender now.
Man, she did catch a break in the elimination challenge in that, like, although she wasn't excited to do dessert, bread pudding is a great supper club idea, and also definitely something that's in the barbecue wheelhouse, you know? So I feel like that it was a good challenge for her, but she has had a consistent, if you're looking for highest floor, she's probably it now that Rosica had this week.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously you worry about the barbecue background and how versatile it's going to be, but she keeps making, like, she hadn't really made a bad dish.
Yeah, the only thing that wasn't good is the raisin and ham sauce, which, again, I think we're both going to give her a pass.
Yeah, I think you get a pass. Raisin and ham sauce, remember, like, with improvised ingredients on top of that, right?
Yeah, so, right, with ingredients you bought before knowing what you were making. It was a real screw job, no doubt.
Yeah.
And
what do you think, by the way, about the whole steakless quickfire? Did we talk about this last week?
Well, it's steaks, but they're cash steaks.
Yeah, I don't know.
I preferred it the other way around because, and it cemented for me this week because I had watched the previous ones in close proximity. But this week, when we watch the quickfire and Charlie wins, and I love Charlie, RIP, and they're like, oh, man, we took one bite of your Creole sauce and it was over. This was spectacular. And then we get to the elimination and it's like, oh, by the way, friggin', I don't even remember who it was, has immunity. Rosica or?
I think, I don't Michelle? Remember. It was Rosica, right? Because he was saying...
It was either Rosica or Michelle. Anyway,
it was wasn't there a whole thing about what dish Rosica was going to make? And then she's like, oh, but I have immunity.
Maybe, but she got to make what she wanted, I think. So I don't know. I can't remember. Somebody had immunity, and that's the point, right?
It's the winner of the last episode, right?
Yes, but this is my point. Is like we're having a whole conversation about it. I would rather it be more proximal, so to speak. Like,
yeah.
I like the effect of you win the quickfire. Now you know you're safe for the immediate subsequent challenge. Like, I think I understand the theory of the elimination challenges are the real focus, so we want those to provide immunity, but also, like...
But they are automatically focused because they eliminate someone and everyone.
Exactly. And I would add to that, like, beyond that, that's a philosophy that sounds nice, but we're making a TV show, and this is just not as... It's the lesser option, I think, pretty clearly.
You can just tell it's not an improvement. So,
no. I don't know, maybe it's Supper Club standard, but the way they served the food was weird. Like the combinations of things that came at the same time. I don't know. It was a weird challenge.
Yeah, we need to get some more Supper Club experience so we can speak to that, I suppose.
Do we?
Okay, maybe we don't. I'm going to try one of these days.
Yeah, I mean, why not? But I'm not. It's not something that's high on my list. Like, if I'm going to spend the money that probably requires, I think I want a different experience.
I don't think they're super expensive. I don't. So maybe at one restaurant it might have been super expensive.
It also might just have to do with access. Like, you know, I don't know how you even.
It's not like you're real far from Wisconsin.
No, but how do you even like figure out? I don't know. I don't know how they work.
But you could be in Madison in 90 minutes, right?
Yeah, it's probably more like 2 or 3 hours, but yeah, I can get there.
Certainly Milwaukee's like an hour, right?
Milwaukee's close, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anything else you got on Top Chef?
I think 2 hours, 18 minutes, it says on the maps. It's about 100 miles.
Okay.
Just back to Kevin real quick, because I just want to finish talking about the French chef that's not good at cooking. I don't know how.
Is it Kevin or Kevin?
I don't know, but how do you put that steak on a plate? I could see on TV it was raw.
I thought it looked good on TV, actually, but.
But he called it medium rare, and you could see them like you could see.
Not medium rare, definitely rare.
I mean, it was rare. It was, and that's just weird. Like, you know, it's and one thing if you
can't make. I thought it was, frankly, I thought Manny's undercooking of the beef was a bigger mistake than the overcooking of the fish.
I kind of agree with that. I don't know. It makes me think the fish must have been like rock hard, because otherwise, like, slightly overcooked fish is definitely better than chewy steak.
No, it sounds like, but this sounds like it was not slightly overcooked.
That's the thing. It sounds like, and listen, as soon as he put it on, right? I have a note. I wrote that fish is going to be cold by the time it gets to them, because I figured he'd take it off.
Yeah.
At the appropriate, you know, doneness, and then it would be sitting. Instead, he cooked it forever.
The bottom line here is that we had multiple dishes, and I want to say as many as three, maybe even more, that were described by the judges as inedible.
Yes.
And that is just not up to the standard of this show.
No, it's not. It's like, not. And unfortunately,
inedible is different from bad.
It is, and I didn't think Charlie was one of those. So I was kind of bummed when he got eliminated. Yeah, so
Charlie was definitely one of those. The Charlie's was definitely described as inedible.
All right. Well, in any event, I was disappointed when he got eliminated, especially after winning the, you know, the quickfire challenge. And I thought, you know, he just got in his head because his last fish was undercooked.
Yeah.
So he was like, I got to make sure it's not undercooked. And obviously went way over the top. And I think, you know, in retrospect, to cook fish for 25 minutes, you have to like be distracted. Like something has to go wrong. But I don't know. Manny having a steak that they couldn't eat felt worse to me. And the Danny, I think, got a break because they could tell he got screwed on the budget. So it was a weird one.
Really considering Danny's at all, it seemed like it was much more about Manny and
It was Manny and Charlie because I thought Laura was the one who should have been eliminated.
Right, I think Laura was more in consideration than Danny was. Maybe. I think they liked Danny's enough.
Yeah, maybe, but I don't know. For me, she's the one responsible for Danny's bad dish, basically. She made her own bad dish with all that money. And, like, I don't know. I get it, but Charlie at least, like, you know, they like one of the sauces. I don't know. To me, it... overcooked fish is not good, but undercooked steak and bad overwrought dessert seemed worse. But maybe I just like Charlie.
Yeah, you do. I think Charlie's pretty likable. Yeah. So, you know, one of the better ITMs on the show. And
yeah, totally.
Oh, all right. Let's talk about some shows.
All right.
You want to start with Franklin?
Sure.
I'm curious what you thought of this one.
I think it is a bold choice to spend this much money because it reeks of dough.
It does reek of dough. That's correct.
On a show about statecraft. That's what it is. Yeah. It's a television show about the making of a country.
Diplomacy.
Yeah, it's diplomacy. Yeah. And there is some interesting stuff in diplomacy, but it feels like when you take this big a swing, you would have, I don't know, like a bigger ball. I don't know if that's the right way to murder that analogy, but like what's the best case scenario for a Michael Douglas show about diplomacy in terms of audience? I don't know. I kind of like it. He is delightful. He has found, I don't know how much you know about Ben Franklin.
Some.
But I feel like Michael Douglas has found a really nice sweet spot for this character where he is, he encompasses many of the diverse parts of the human that was Ben Franklin. He was like a noted, you know, sort of clever dickhead with sort of religiously inspired difficult rules about living that he didn't always follow. And, you know, a womanizer.
Yeah, I knew he was horny, but man, they really played that up.
With very strict ideas. Well, that relationship is real. That's a real story about a lady that he did not sleep with, but like got in some trouble for flirting with some dude's wife.
Yeah.
So, like, it's interesting. If you are actually interested in what precisely Ben Franklin was getting up to when he visited France to recruit French support for the Revolutionary War, because that's what it's about. It's a lot of true stuff. I mean, I'm sure there's some liberties, but it's a lot of true stuff. It's really where he was, really with his grandson, really just pouncing about town, trying to solicit some cash.
We have had some contentious debates on this show over the last, however many years. Contentious is not even the right word, but you know, like we've been on
opposite sides.
Of opinions.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever said anything that I'm more on opposite side of than Michael Douglas is giving, has found the sweet spot and giving a layered performance as Ben Franklin.
I didn't say layered. I don't think.
I think Michael Douglas is playing Michael Douglas and it's fucking jarring. And this show is a big swing and it is like it's one of those like Marcell Ozuna, I am trying to hit a 17 run home run and oops, I missed. And now I am on one knee and in the dirt.
Is why I asked, how much do you know about Ben Franklin? Cause I actually think, I don't know if that's what Michael Douglas is like. I do think that's kind of what Ben Franklin was like. And
Franklin might have been, but this Michael Douglas is just being Michael Douglas.
It's there are some
enactments off him. He doesn't need any of the glasses and the suit.
It feels anachronistic in moments in that way. I'm not going to argue with you, but I actually think that is
they're the same guy.
I think it's a clever and interesting way of capturing who Ben Franklin really was. Yeah, I do.
I feel like the grandson is like carrying this show on his back.
It's funny. That's
vastly more interesting than the Ben Franklin scenes. And the show's called Franklin.
Things don't go well for that kid. later in life. I don't know. I'm not going to argue with you that it's a distinct And it's a performance that stands out. You can't ignore what he's doing. But I don't think it's an accident. I don't think it's an accident, and I do think it is the right character for that performance.
I don't know enough about Brent
Franklin. When you think about Michael Douglas, I guess you think about kind of like a salty old clever dickhead that is a little big for his britches and overly clever. But that's exactly who I think of when I think of Ben Franklin as well.
All right. This show, it didn't work a ton for me. I went a little hard on the Marcelo Zuna thing. I wasn't like, this is unwatchable. Get me out of here. But I'm also not super anxious to return to it either.
Well, I'll say this. If the performance that he's giving bothers you, I don't see how you could keep watching it. Because in your face, man.
It is. It sure is.
It's not. The show's, it's not for the faint of heart in terms of Michael Douglas's performance.
It's like he basically turned Ben Franklin into a monk, I sort of feel like. Yeah, not obviously, the quirks are different, you know what I mean? But it's like, here's this guy and his quirks, but he gets the job done, you know what I mean?
But I mean, that is essentially the story of who Ben Franklin is at this time in his life. He's an old man. He has, as several people point out, no real official role in the government. He put his name on some shit, and otherwise he's just a guy who flies kites and tinkers with things. he's a printer. He's an idea man.
Yeah.
But he's sent over to do this critically important.
He's not a printer at the point I watch, because they broke all his printing shit.
Well, don't worry. There are twists and turns to that portion of the story. But he is basically sent over there, cleverly, in fact, because they just need somebody to, spar with the French ruling class until they can connive something out of it. And he's keenly positioned to do that.
The French to English switching back and forth also seems to be a bit random at times.
Yeah, that is true.
But that's another story for another day. They weren't going to do that show mostly in French, right?
So, no, exactly.
Is what it is. Yeah. Can we talk about the other Apple TV show thing that we watched?
Well, there's two, but yeah.
Oh, there is. You're right.
But I think you mean Sugar.
I do mean Sugar. Look, I think if Franklin is swinging for the fences, Sugar's trying to draw a walk. You know what I mean?
I was going to say, going the other way through the infield for a single.
Yeah, yeah, that might be it. Or, yeah, maybe even trying to move the runner over.
Because, drawing a walk or moving the runner over feels very rote. And I would say that, although this is not new territory, it's more specific than that, right?
Yeah.
It's the knocking it the other way through the infield for a single that, you might not appreciate if you don't watch a lot of baseball. It's a
genre show.
It's
not aiming super high.
It is so genre, it just has random clips of things from the genre throughout it.
I will watch Colin Farrell just playing an old PI.
Yeah.
Who's really sensitive for some reason.
Well, and there's clearly, I think where this show falls in terms, there's still a chance the second baseman is going to dive and make this play. Because there's clearly something at a higher level going on that I can't tell if it's stupid yet. Right? I mean, how many have you watched?
I only watched two.
Okay. It might be the third one where it really. I mean, I think through two.
That's going to look enough.
Well, but even through two, you can tell that, there's something funky going on with, his handler and this. There's, there's a sort of unknown party of influence involved in this mystery, right?
Yes. There definitely are some powers that be.
Right.
That we
and there's a kind of I don't even know how to describe it. If you haven't watched, there's a, I guess I would broadly say a dinner party that, in fact, he has that invitation in the first episode, I believe. That yeah. weird invitation. Have you seen the event?
Well, now I'm trying to remember because I watched this at the beginning of last week.
you would remember. The event is like at his handler's house. And there's a bunch of people who would remember it.
No, I have not seen that.
Okay. So, yeah, there's a development in the third episode that makes it clear that, like, there's something else going on here, and we don't totally know what it is, and that's on purpose. Well, it is a noir, right?
Yeah.
It leans hard into virtually every classic noir concept and I don't even want to say trope, because, I don't know, for me, they're just doing the genre, right? Like, this is what you do. And I think if it's nothing more than doing the genre with Colin Farrell doing his thing as a crusty old investigator, I'm here for it.
There's a pretty deep cast here too, right?
Yeah. I like a lot of the people, but I'm just saying if that's all it is, I'm still here for it. So, this one's going to have a hard time really disappointing me, I think.
Yeah, although I'm starting to think now that I may put it away for a little bit.
So you can binge it.
So I can binge, yeah.
Well, I think that's becoming more of a regular thing for me because it's just too hard to keep up with 17 active shows at once, you know?
Yeah, we're watching one a week and, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I agree. So May 17th is when the last episode comes out. There are only 8.
Yeah. Yeah, so I, you know, it's interesting, and I expect it'll amount to something interesting. This feels more like what we had said about Apple TV maybe 6 months ago, that, like, almost everything they do seems to be well done and just, like, a good version of whatever it is, with the exception of The Morning Show, which is the craziest version.
yeah. You're getting stars and a lot of money spent in all of it.
Yep. But, and this is just, like, I have no, in terms of like ABCs of how to make a noir, this is a no notes situation. They're doing all the stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right. So our other Apple TV thing that I left off is Steve.
Right? Steve. Look, I know this is just a 4-hour documentary about Steve Martin, but it was by far my favorite thing we watched this week. I thought it was so much fun and also so interesting. And also, when you get right down to it, if I could start from the beginning and live any life in the history of mankind, Steve Martin is like on the medal, on the podium for that. As crazy and you neurotic.
Martin's life, really?
To
take away from that,
to have that level of like success and impact, and then to be calmly serene and delightfully happy in retirement, in essentially retirement, sounds wonderful to me.
I mean, look, yeah, I do think it's interesting, right, that he is the rare person who did seem to find happiness as he got older and after he like way past when he got successful, if that makes sense.
Way
right?
past.
Like, it's like he took all that fame sort of gives you and found a way to turn that into happiness, which I think is sort of a rare story in Hollywood. Right.
And not just happiness, but like normal happiness in the little joys of life.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. In a normal happiness, a happiness that doesn't really seem to revolve around him being famous.
Right, or even rich, you know? Like, obviously, Steve Martin has tons of conveniences in his life. And
occasionally, you get a shot of his house, and you're like, oh, yeah, that guy's rich.
Right, and the art alone, right? But,
right.
But the thing that, like, the happiness he's found seems to be very, like, internal and small in a beautiful way.
Yep. And yeah, and I think he's clearly an interesting mind. He's always been an interesting mind.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
But also kind of a weird guy that I think has trouble really relating to people.
Totally.
Clearly, his family did a number on him.
Yep. Although
I mean,
the relationship he has with Martin Short is beautiful as well, because those are just two guys that clearly relate so well to each other in every way. They have this kind of preternatural feel for each other, and they're so funny together.
Yeah.
And I just laughed so much watching this. There was so much. I have somewhere, probably somewhere in this house, the compact disc of that album.
Oh, you do?
With the balloon on his head. I have a couple of Steve Martin albums. I loved Steve Martin as a kid. And who wouldn't? Like, he is... That's
interesting. I see, you know, I certainly watched Saturday Night Live and some of his movies, but I don't think I ever really experienced a ton of his stand-up.
Well, it was this hilarious...
After a while, you know what I mean, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I went on a little... I had a stand-up obsession as a child, so I had, like, some Richard Pryor albums and... Steve Martin and George Carlin, and anyway, yeah, I'm a weird guy.
I kind of, you know, got into watching stand-up, you know.
You know what it was, is I saw Delirious when I was quite young, and I was like, holy shit, what else is there like this?
Well, Steve Martin was funny, but I would not say he was a whole lot like Delirious.
Well, it was down the road, right? I mean, that's down the road. You go from Delirious to Pryor to Carlin, and then you just start looking for other famous comedians. But yep. Obviously I knew who Steve Martin was, right? So that was fascinating to me that this guy who I'd seen in Roxanne and you know, Father of the Bride was the biggest comedian in the world.
Yeah, really.
I mean,
was.
I think people forget he really was the biggest comedian in the world for a little while, and like rock star huge.
Yeah. Well, and like, I mean, that's like, he basically quit doing stand-up because it was too easy, right? Like, people were just laughing.
Yeah.
You know?
Too easy is one way of looking at it. But yeah, what he was essentially saying is that, like, it no longer felt like he was doing anything worthwhile because, yeah, people were just, like, slappy and so ready to laugh that the material ceased to matter.
Yeah. Well, and I didn't, that's one thing for me is, like, I didn't know people were... you know, showing up at it shows with pencils, you know, hanging out of their head and stuff. You know what I mean? Or like, yeah, when man. They like Steve, they show the footage from like the Steve Martin night and all these people are like doing Steve Martin. Like, I didn't know stuff like that was going on. You know what I mean?
Well, it reminds me of that joke, Eddie Murphy in Delirious. You know, I'm realizing in this conversation how much that stand-up set affected my life. But he has that line about where he does the guy doing him at the water cooler.
Yeah.
You know? And then he had G.I. Joe in his ass. So, yeah. I think that in some ways is the bane of every comedian.
For sure. Well, certainly if you reach the status of those two guys. You know what I mean?
No doubt. And I do think it probably, like, I can imagine how it got weird seeing crowds of people with, like, a common, you know, dime store gag wearing it like a totem to you.
Yeah.
It is also just a fascinating life. I mean, in every respect.
100%. Great feel for a documentary. I don't entirely know that it needed to be sort of that Eagles two hours for both sides, but both sides are interesting. So,
right.
One where part one radically eclipses part two.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness to the Eagles documentary, part one of the Eagles radically eclipses part two.
That's what I mean. That's what I'm saying. The Eagles documentary, I thought, was much more one-sided.
I'm saying the band.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough.
Like, the documentary was honest.
Right.
That's unfortunately,
documentary like, shouldn't have been two parts like that.
Yeah,
you know,
agreed. You could just yada yada the second half of that band's career is what you're saying.
That should have been 30 minutes on the second half. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think the band just wasn't going to permit that. You know what I mean?
Right. I'll tell you what. Morgan Neville, getting back to
the man that first
part documentary.
Sorry.
Morgan Neville's good at this.
I don't like the Eagles that much. It's so great though. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying, Morgan Neville, he's pretty good at this.
Yeah, for sure.
This is It's a very good documentary filmmaker.
Strong recommendation on that. What about Scoop? That's our last one.
I didn't hate it. I also
didn't hate it.
It's nothing like Franklin in any way, other than I question the necessity of a film about the journalism, so to speak, of this situation.
Yeah, it's you know, like, I feel like it's sort of like trying to tell a similar story of like Spotlight, right?
Well, right, but compared to Spotlight, this is nothing. This is one lady who, great job by her, but like one lady who leveraged some relationships to get a big interview that only really happened because he had no choice. And then
she positioned herself to be the person that they would use when he needed,
when he had no choice. Exactly.
Yeah. Which is so much different. Spotlight, which is people like basically actively trying to not have this story told ever. You know,
right.
What I mean?
And journalists doing the like legwork of journalism, yeah, in a way that speaks to the job, but also to the, you know, there's just so much more to Spotlight. This is not that. And although she did her job spectacularly, and I don't want to take any credit away from her, when the postscript is effectively like, and she did get to stand in the room for an important interview because she did such a good job booking it. part of me is like,
well, the post paid, and then eventually she quit the BBC because she wanted to do something more important.
Right. And part of me is like, we paid guys $15 an hour to book our guests.
Yeah.
And again, it's no shade to her because that's not the same as what she did. But like, it's not an interesting job, really, in the way, and there's not a story to tell in the way that there is about journalists chasing down leads and going after, you know what I'm saying? This is like, just like
work. She was really persuasive, you know what, right. I mean? And charming when she needed to be, and like, she stood up to people at work who didn't think she was doing anything worthwhile, and like, that's cool. It's all cool. It's just,
right.
I don't know if, like, when you're comparing it to something like Spotlight, it does feel a little bit lightweight. And I'm wondering if the angle of a deep dive into the journalism that made this happen was really the best way to approach this particular story.
That's my exact thought. And I think it's a classic, you know, getting the wrong takeaway from a celebrated and excellent film, which is like, the reason Spotlight told the story of Spotlight is because the story of the journalists was an incredible story. Now, if we're looking broadly historically, it's true that the bigger story is the Catholic Church being a bunch of pedophiles, but there is a real and interesting and exciting and stakes-filled story.
I don't even know if it, you know, I mean, I'm like, I don't want to get in an argument. I don't even know if it's a bigger story. I mean, you're talking about some of the most powerful people in the world, and the crime is, the crimes are the same, essentially, right?
No. You're misunderstanding me. I'm saying, broadly, historically, the story of the priests is a bigger story than the story of the journalists.
But, oh, God. Yeah, of course.
But,
okay.
But the reason to tell it through the eyes of the journalists is because it speaks to aspects of that story, and also there's a real, you know, it speaks to the cover up, right? And yeah, there's a real stakes filled, you know, plot in the journalism, and I just don't think any of those things are in place here, and so it makes it feel like you're taking for no particular reason like a 60,000 foot view of the horrible thing that happened.
They're kind of in place, you know what I mean? Like, it's like there's kind of a cover up. There's kind, you know what I mean? Like, they're definitely powerful people who don't want this to get out. There's, but like,
sure, but it does. Ultimately
it does get
ultimately so, he just hangs himself, right? Ultimately she doesn't necessarily do that work.
The FBI is doing that work ultimately. Right. Yeah.
Right. And we don't get any of that.
Yeah. So,
it's just, I agree. It's a weird choice. It's just a weird, it's not a bad movie. It's just a weird choice to tell this story this way.
Right. And at the same, but at the same time, we haven't mentioned Gillian Anderson, who I think is...
She was great. Billy Piper was great.
Yeah. So, like, it's a watchable movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a lot breezier than, say, Spotlight, because, you know what I mean? It's the gourmet cheeseburger version of Spotlight.
Basically. Yeah, maybe. Maybe yeah. that's... and maybe that's exactly what it's supposed to be.
It's glossier and way less weightier, and and you think you're going to think a lot less during
yep.
it.
Yep.
Yeah. There you go.
Think a lot less. It's true. It's true.
All right. That wraps us up for this week, I think, right?
Yeah, I think it does.
Homework-wise, we're going to keep it light because you're going to Vegas, right?
Vegas, baby.
So we saved the new Sunday night HBO show, which is The Sympathizer.
Yeah. And by the way,
Sandra,
I'm also going to try to get through The Regime so we can talk about that. But I think in many ways, The Regime was just a bridge to The Sympathizer, because I think this is HBO's swing for the big new Sunday night thing.
Yeah. I mean, look, we can get into The Regime and what that was when you finish.
Yeah.
But I would not. I think it's fair to say The Regime was not a massive swing for sure. And then we're also going to check out Fallout, which is the Amazon Prime, right?
Yep.
Based on a video game that I did not play, but it was really popular. And so we'll see how that goes. I think a lot of people are watching this show. So
a lot of people seem to be watching it and saying it's watchable at least. So I'm interested. I've never really played Fallout. I think I like hung out with a friend who was playing for an hour or two one time. But so I like some of the stuff is familiar to me vaguely, but I definitely am not like a Fallout expert. So we'll see how it plays for the non-video game crowd.
We may get into some basketball too. Are you what's your level of Chicago Bulls excitement right now as a Chicago Bulls fan?
On a scale of what?
Why 1 to 10 is probably the easiest.
I'd say I'm like a solid 2.7.
All right. All right.
I can't get excited about this team until it has a future. And by that I mean like a plan for the future. Not that there are no good young players on this team. I think there are good young players, or at least player on this team. I seen no strategy from an organizational perspective, and as much fun as it is to win a couple play-in games, which I think is certainly possible, if not likely, because they won the first one and the second one is going to be without its best player. The right to get smushed by the Celtics seems trivial to me when the organization has no plan to be better than play-in territory in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, that'll get you a solid 2.5.
A 2.7, because it is fun, man. And Kobe was awesome, and I love Kobe White. I really do.
I mean, clearly that's the thing that to come out of the season, right? It's like, oh, shit, we found a point guard.
Yeah, you know, if they go ahead and re-sign DeRozan and can't move Vucevic, then we're back to the same dumb shit next year.
Yep. I want DeRozan to bring his daughter back and have her scream at free throws.
Yeah, and DR wasn't there for game one. What's up with that?
Yeah, I don't get it. She's amazing. All right, I got to go.
All right, bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.